when a crazy person shoots up a synagogue, we don't say he was just crazy. There's no reason to implicate anti-Semitism in it. It found the target that it did because of the culture he was in.
In the wake of last week's shootings, the media struggle with the question of causation. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In its fight with publishing giant Hachette, Amazon seems to have thrown its customers under the bus.
I mean, they're making it harder for their customers to get books, to have a good experience on the Kindle, to have quick delivery. These are values that they've trumpeted for the past 20 years, and here in this dispute, they seem to have abandoned them.
And the confessions of a former tabloid hack.
I'd like to say that was the bottom of my particular journalistic barrel, but here's me dressed in a burqa. Yup, a burqa.
There's more coming up after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week in Isla Vista, California, 22-year-old Elliot Roger killed 6 people and wounded 13 others before killing himself. The media leapt to find out why he did what he did. And they found a digital footprint complete with YouTube videos, an autobiographical manifesto, and comments on the message boards of self-styled men's rights groups, comments filled with rage about his inability to attract a beautiful woman. The instant psychoanalysis of a killer and of a society was underway. The implication of blame reached absurd heights when Washington Post film critic Anne Hornaday wrote that Hollywood movies could help us understand the killing spree. She singled out director Judd Apatow, whose films often feature a schlubby everyman getting the girl. That assertion led to a dust-up. Hornaday went online to tamp down.
In singling out Neighbors and Judd Apatow, I by no means meant to cast blame on those movies or Judd Apatow's work for this heinous action, obviously not. But I do think, again, it bears asking what the costs are of having such a narrow range of stories that we constantly go back to.
When you gesture towards causality, it's hard to pull back. Forbes writer Kashmir Hill says that the digital detritus left behind by Roger can be harvested to make whatever argument the media want to make.
This 137-page manifesto, writings he'd left behind on bodybuilding.com and puahate.com, an anti-pickup artist site, as well as his YouTube profile and Facebook profile, there was so much there that if you're pro-gun control, you could say, well, it was the fault of guns, or if you're disturbed by misogyny in Hollywood culture, you could point to what he had said around that, mental health and what he may have been diagnosed with, and if that was to blame. Really, if you came at this with an agenda, there was something there for you, and you could attack it from that angle. And I think people are really quick to do that.
And yet, episodes like this create a journalistic dilemma, because surely it is the job of the media to help the public understand why such a crime takes place. But the process of doing that leads the public to jump to conclusions, often very unfair conclusions that lay blame places where it isn't deserved. What's a journalist to do?
My impulse, when there's lots of information there, review that information and then try to curate and compile it in a way that will make it digestible for my readers. So that's what I did. I mean, it was the start of the Memorial Day weekend, and I basically started just reading everything I could find online, you know, touching on the various things I could find without my making a decision about what caused him to do this.
In this case, even his own words plucked from his so-called manifesto failed to provide any kind of full story, correct?
I actually have been calling it an autobiography rather than a manifesto. So it really is that. It is going through his life since birth and him basically psychoanalyzing himself. And this is where I thought Anne Hornaday had a point. There was something kind of cinematic in the way that he laid it out, almost as if his autobiography was a screenplay. Not that Hollywood is to blame. That's not what I'm saying. But it seemed like he was very aware of the digital trail that he was leaving, more so than any of the other people I've seen who have committed these atrocious acts.
The logical fallacies that are so at the heart of some of the finger-pointing are kind of breathtaking, are they not?
I found it very disturbing that people were willing to blame a group so quickly. I mean, around the men's rights movement, somebody wrote, I think it was an article on the Daily Kos, that because he subscribed to three YouTube channels where people give advice on how to pick up women, obviously this group is to blame. And then I think it leads to this really unhealthy dialogue where each side of the debate has such an extreme caricature of the other side. So all pickup artists and men's rights movement people are, you know, on the verge of mass murdering people. And then they're throwing this back at feminists saying, oh, you think that all men are on the verge of killing people. And it just becomes this unproductive debate.
I wonder if you catch yourself at any point in your writing from drawing conclusions that were misleading.
His Facebook page was full of selfies. There were very few photos of anybody else, picture after picture of himself. I think I focused on that in my write-up, that this person had this kind of pathological narcissism. I think I said something on Twitter about, you know, this would make me concerned when I saw any other Facebook profile that was full of selfies. And there was a person who responded to me on that who thought that that was really an unhealthy conclusion to draw.
Kashmir, what have we learned?
What was most disturbing to me in all this is that there was this really fulsome digital footprint. Based on the comments that he'd left on some of these forums and on the YouTube videos, concerns have been raised. There were people on this bodybuilding forum that said, you're channeling Patrick Bateman. These videos are serial killer-esque.
Patrick Bateman was the character in American Psycho, the homicidal maniac in that story.
People seem to see it. I mean, police visited Elliot Rodger's apartment and questioned him. His family were concerned on the night that this happened. They were racing in a car to his apartment. So I guess what I take away from it is that it was all there. Everyone had a sense that something terrible was coming, and they didn't stop it or couldn't stop it.
Now, there's one interesting footnote to this. In going into the message boards of some of these subcultures, like the bodybuilders and the pickup artists, you discover that far from just giving the most fertile ground for the seeds of his rage, there was pushback.
It seemed like people who were analyzing this had decided just because he was on those sites, he was having his ideas about women reaffirmed. And he did write that in his autobiography, that PUAHate.com confirmed his theories about women being wicked and degenerate. But when I was actually looking at the conversations that were happening, I saw people questioning him. He wrote a lot about how he thought women were stupid or how he hated seeing ugly men with beautiful women. There were a lot of racially charged comments that he was making as well. And the people were pushing back and saying, you know, what really gets women is not your wealth or how you dress. It's being fun to be around. It wasn't this forum of celebrating a hatred of women. There were people who disagreed with him and who were challenging him.
Kashmir, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Kashmir Hill is a staff writer for Forbes.
Those groups, despite some pushback, did, in their generally grudging or acquisitive stance toward women, provide a kind of home for Rodger. And the focus of the national conversation, especially on social media, quickly shifted to the scourge of misogyny. Many men responded with the Twitter hashtag, not all men, as in not all men are violent, a phrase often invoked in response to wider conversations about violence against women. And many women answered with the Yes, All Women hashtag, asserting that while not all men are predators, all women are culturally conditioned to fear male violence. Yes, All Women also inspired a Tumblr called When Women Refuse, which is collecting news stories across the globe about violence committed against women who refuse male advances. Deanna Zant is one of the Tumblr's co-creators and a media technologist. She says Yes, All Women debuted soon after the horrible news emerged Memorial Day weekend, and it thrives, even though the originator subsequently shut down her Twitter account.
Yes, that's right. Early on in these conversations, it's a very frequent occurrence for women to receive all kinds of harassment and threats to get them to shut down their public profiles, which is exactly what's happened to this woman, I think. They use the threat of violence, sexual assault, publicizing your private information. I've been through it many times, and that's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying.
But violent, hateful speech is kind of a fact of life online.
these conversations are a mirror of what's actually happening in our culture, where when we have free and open spaces to have these conversations, these are the types of things that come out. On the other side, though, that stuff isn't the norm. The productive, amazing conversations and connectivity that happens when we share with one another strengthens our communities and our bonds and our actions offline.
Have you taken a look at the Not All Men hashtag stream lately?
I can't bring myself to go there.
Do you think that two parallel arguments are happening without much intersection?
Well, people who are having one conversation will often use the opposing hashtag to kind of bait the other side into getting into some sort of discussion. Often those conversations aren't terribly productive because it is a baiting exercise. What I do see happening frequently are other smaller discussions. I know of a group of men who are meeting via Facebook right now to talk about the impossible expectations that American masculinity puts on men and ends up breaking them in some ways, and figuring out what role feminism can do to alleviate some of that toxicity.
Are you making an effort to separate this at all from the Isla Vista shooting, just so that you don't get charged with taking advantage of a tragedy that isn't directly connected to your cultural critique?
Yeah, a lot of people have made that criticism. We haven't actually been on the receiving end of it so much, because in the about page of the site, we talk about the origin of where this idea came from and that it's sort of taken on a life of its own.
Are you hazarding taking correlation and making it causation?
I definitely feel pretty strongly against the causation part. It's one of the reasons why we decided not to take personal stories at this time. I wanted to just share documented news stories specifically of women who have been victims of violence when they have rejected men in their lives or otherwise, or even strangers. And I'm actually hoping to use this site as a tapestry that we can weave together to demonstrate really what's happening in our culture, that these are not isolated incidents.
First of all, does it take a hashtag to start this kind of conversation? And then what do you expect it to achieve?
A hashtag isn't required, but is super useful, often in the same way that Yes We Can and Sí Se Puede become rallying cries for a movement. Hashtags are doing the same thing in the digital space. And what I see happening here whenever we have these extremely emotional moments that are very traumatic for a lot of people, most people, before they come to a conversation, they feel isolated. They feel like they're the only ones that this happened to. So when they start sharing their stories with one another, they realize, I'm not crazy for feeling this way. I'm not crazy for feeling scared in this situation. It's very much like digital consciousness raising. Consciousness raising of the second wave of feminism was such a huge part of the movement in connecting women together and people together to share their stories of systemic problems and make systemic change.
Someday, this hashtag will stop trending.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens then?
There's a lot of discussion right now around the lifespan and the life cycle of a hashtag. I find them very useful as in-the-moment tools. Those tweets will live on until someone deletes them. They will become an archive and a reference point, a point for journalists to dig into stories as other related stories come up. It doesn't have to be a platform at every given moment.
After Sandy Hook, there was such a strong movement and a strong possibility that there would be some substantive gun control.
Mm-hmm.
It never happened. Mm-hmm. I know it's a rich lobby, the NRA,
mm-hmm.
but it would seem that it would take decades for a change in the kind of culture that you're pointing out in the Tumblr.
I don't actually think that it has to take decades. You know, we look at something like street harassment. Emily May started an organization called Holla Back to start fighting street harassment, I think, almost 10 years ago. And many people said, what? Catcalling? Why is that dangerous? Why is that bad? And some people still obviously say that. But the headway that they've been able to make as a movement around the world has been incredible for people to stand up and say, wait a minute, no, that does feel bad and dangerous when that happens to me on the street. And that's only been less than a decade. So again, the power of digital tools to really shift a cultural consciousness is incredible at this moment if we use the tools wisely.
What's the biggest impediment?
Apathy. people feeling apathetic because they've never felt like they've been able to move a needle before. And I think these are some of the differences that we're seeing when people are contributing to these social media moments. This is oftentimes their first experience with contributing to some sort of social change, and they see what happens when it goes from their Twitter stream to their local news station or to a mainstream cable news station or something on the radio.
Deanna, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Deanna Zandt is the author of Share This, How You Will Change the World with Social Networking. So we go back and forth. Is discussing a persistent global horror, violence against women, appropriate in the wake of one angry lunatic's rampage? Absolutely, wrote actor, writer, and former Jeopardy champion Arthur Chu in The Daily Beast. Yes, Rogers was mentally ill, but his illness expressed itself in a particular way and reveals something about Rogers' subculture, Arthur Chu's nerd culture, and the wider culture in which we all live.
He was a regular poster on a forum called PUA Hate. PUA stands for Pickup Artist. It's like teaching you how to make money from home, teaching you how to sell cars. But they apply principles like that to how to, you know, get women, ranging from common sense stuff like dress better and work out and look better to, you know, creepy stuff, how to manipulate women or pressure women or bully women, talking about isolating women from their friends. And PUA Hate is another level of this where there's guys who have paid lots and lots of money for the seminars and the books, and it still doesn't work. And now they're left with even more resentment. Elliot Rodger was part of a subculture. And he didn't make up any of the things he said in that video. He was quoting almost like verbatim concepts repeated again and again. As a guy who was introverted and isolated a lot in school, who's had a lot of the same issues that Roger complains about, I've found myself thinking the same way. I've heard guys saying similar things. They don't take it as far as mass murder, but this sense of resentment and entitlement towards women is everywhere.
So let's move from this particularly virulent subculture and talk about how broader cultural tropes actually resonate with this. You reference Saved by the Bell and Steve Urkel, along with The Big Bang Theory and Niles on Frasier and so on.
Well, Steve Urkel, his whole character was developed because he's the guy who has this hopeless crush on this girl.
You know, I've asked you out a thousand times and you have said no a thousand times. I am beginning to notice an alarming trend.
Get a clue, Steve. Give it up.
I shall never give up bubbling brown sugar. In fact, I'm gonna do something so romantic, so gallant, and so fabulously grandiose that your heart will melt and you will be mine forever.
You know, The Big Bang Theory, to its credit, is better than that. Leonard and Penny are not like Steve and Laura on Family Matters. But if Steve Urkel were real, he would be a criminal. Breaking into someone's house, harassing someone, standing outside their window. And these are things that all actually happen to real people. If you follow Yes All Women on Twitter, you hear all these stories from women about guys who literally do these things. And they don't see themselves as the bad guy because to themselves, they're the victim. That's why I singled out quote-unquote nerds. You know, I'm not talking about liking science fiction or liking comic books. I'm talking about the sense of I'm the victim, and anyone who contributes to that feeling of loneliness and exclusion is a victimizer.
You mention in particular Revenge of the Nerds.
Revenge of the Nerds is an old movie. The 1980s, it's long enough ago that we can see there was some messed up stuff in these films that at the time were considered, you know, hilarious, entertaining, fun movies. So Revenge of the Nerds uses the bed trick, involves a guy sleeping with another guy's girlfriend in disguise, which meets the definition of rape.
You're that nerd.
Yeah. Oh
God, you were wonderful.
Thanks.
Are all nerds as good as you?
Yes.
How come?
Because all jocks think about is sports. All we ever think about is sex.
You know, I can have sex with a woman so well without her consent that she'll retroactively consent. That's not a cool message. I'm not saying I have no sympathy. I was one of those guys. Being a lonely guy sucks. Being lonely sucks. But the real problem isn't that we have stories from a perspective of a lonely guy who wants love and affection, but that men and women mostly see stories about how hard it is to be a man looking for love, and the woman's role is to provide that. So it's just a conversation that we need to have. I don't want it to be about me and these assertions that I made when people say, like, what's right. your evidence? I don't have the evidence. I'm telling you what these women have been sharing for days ever since, you know, Memorial Day weekend on Twitter and blog posts and articles, and you can go read them. If another man needs to be the one to tell you to read them for you to feel like you need to hear these stories, that's kind of messed up, but I'll do it if that's what it takes.
But as you mentioned, Revenge of the Nerds was 30 years ago. Is there anything to suggest that these attitudes are current in the same way?
A lot of it is couched in satire and irony. I'm not saying we have to take all satire literally, but, you know, get me a sandwich is a meme on the internet. It's a joke that people say to dismissively, if a woman says something, shut up and get me a sandwich, you know, because you think, well, no one's really in an abusive relationship like that anymore. I can joke about it. It's not a big deal. On Gawker, Adrian Chen recently unleashed this tornado of controversy because he outed the anonymity of the guy who founded Creepshots, which is a subreddit about surreptitiously taking pictures of women without their consent. And then people actually saying, well, no, these guys are the underdogs. These guys are introverts who are scared to approach women. So this is how they appreciate women, over and over again. Men painting themselves as the ones who are being wronged here. Louis C.K., when there was this controversy a while ago about Daniel Tosh defending the idea that rape jokes are okay, that they shouldn't be censored, Louis C.K. listens to people. And his routine changed as a result. He did a routine about how scary it is for women to date men.
We're the number one threat to women. If you're a guy, try to imagine that you could only date a half bear, half lion. And you're like, oh, I hope this one's nice.
Who was it? Margaret Atwood said that men are afraid women will laugh at them. Women are afraid men will kill them.
One of the commenters on your article pointed out that what you're really saying isn't just about nerd culture, but also jock culture. So is this narrative that you describe really indicative of how society defines masculinity more broadly?
Oh, well, absolutely. I'm not singling out nerd culture, whatever, because I think that we're worse than other guys. I'm singling it out because I am in that culture. If anything is worse, it's the fact that we are not self-aware about it. It would be one thing if Elliot Rodger had said, I just hate women and want to kill them, but that he had this cloak of self-pity over all of it. And yeah, he was crazy. But when a crazy person shoots up a synagogue, we don't say he was just crazy. There's no reason to implicate anti-Semitism in it. It found the target that it did because of the culture he was in. Most guys aren't going to take a gun and shoot a bunch of random strangers, but there's a lot of guys out there who commit sexual assault. There's a lot of guys out there who commit rape. It happens a lot. When you paint him as a monster and an anomaly and you say his madness has nothing to do with any of the rest of us, and I've literally had guys say, like, misogyny is not an ideology. Misogyny is not a specific thing. What Elliot Rodger did has absolutely nothing to do with any other bad thing that happens to any other woman in the world, then you destroy the point of even talking about it in the first place. The only reason to talk about tragedy, unless you are someone who knows someone who died and you are mourning them, the only reason for you and me to be talking about it is to try to prevent bad things from happening in the future.
Arthur, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Arthur Chu is an actor and writer. His piece in the Daily Beast is called Your Princess is in Another Castle, Misogyny, Entitlement, and Nerds.
Coming up, after the media dissect the perpetrator, how should they handle the victims?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by LegalZoom. According to Forbes.com, approximately 543,000 new businesses get started each month. If you're thinking about starting a business, learn how LegalZoom can help with DBAs, LLCs, incorporation, trademarks, and more at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom provides self-help services and can connect you with an attorney, but they're not a law firm. Enter OTM in the referral box at checkout for a special discount for On the Media listeners. On the Media is supported by GoDaddy. working to put businesses online and featuring a website builder to help attract more customers. Visit GoDaddy.com and enter code 50OFF4 to save on Website Builder Business Plus. Some limitations apply. See website for details.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Following last week's massacre, residents of Isla Vista confronted misery of another kind, the constant presence of cameras. Some students even held signs that read, "Stop filming our tears." But Richard Martinez, whose 20-year-old son Chris was killed in the attack, is turning to the media to campaign for change.
Why did Chris die? Chris died because of craven, irresponsible politicians and the NRA. Too many have died. We should say to ourselves, not one more.
As Karen Duffin reported last fall, the template for that kind of engagement was established back in 1999 after the massacre at Columbine High School.
My name is Craig Scott, and I am a survivor of the Columbine High School shooting. I also lost my sister, Rachel Joy Scott.
Craig was a student trapped in the library during the rampage. As he left the school, he confronted both his trauma and a country anxious to hear about it. Oprah called, Katie Couric called. He went on the Today Show 2 days after Columbine.
Two kids with trench coats on, they came into the library, and they shot Isaiah.
And then you played dead, Craig.
I just ended up laying on the floor. I was praying to God.
Each time a high-profile tragedy occurs, the victims must decide, unsettled and unprepared, whether to share it.
So everything is on the fly, and that creates a lack of perspective about what are the consequences of my doing this or not doing this.
That's Steve Siegel from the Denver District Attorney's Office. He's worked with victims of Columbine, Aurora, Sandy Hook, and many other major tragedies. He says public relations professionals can spend years learning how to calculate how one interview might affect a court case, a relationship, a reputation, 5 weeks or 5 years down the road. It's like playing chess. One move affects the next. But victims don't calculate.
The vast majority of people who are willing to cooperate with the media, they are looking to try to create some sense out of a senseless act.
Craig Scott says talking to the press has been cathartic.
It was therapeutic to be able to talk and have people listen and have people be supportive.
Not everybody wants to do that, and I understand that.
That's Craig's father, Daryl Scott.
It has been not only therapeutic, but it's been a joy because it's like they're still with you as long as you share their memory.
Victims' advocates like Steve Siegel say that the line between an interview feeling cathartic and feeling painful or even re-victimizing is thin. Daryl understood this.
A lot of times, media wants to see emotion, and I personally just made a decision in the early days not to perform for the camera. I don't answer a lot of questions like, how did you feel when you heard that your daughter died? I always just say, you know, like any other parent would feel.
Sometimes victims use the media simply because it's the best way to spread the word.
The parents of Adam Walsh, who's been missing since yesterday noon.
You may recognize that voice.
I'm John Walsh. For 25 years, I've hunted fugitives all over the world. Tonight,
his son Adam was kidnapped from a shopping mall in 1981. He begged the press to cover the story, but he says they barely did. So 1 week into the search, John took some PR advice from an unlikely source.
The county coroner said raise the reward.
This PR-savvy coroner told John to use the most basic tool of PR, a news hook.
It'll intrigue the media. They'll show up, and it will reinvigorate Adam's case.
Sure enough, the local papers showed up. But 2 weeks later, Adam Walsh was found dead. John still believes that press attention could have brought Adam home alive. With reason. As host of America's Most Wanted, he's used the media to help capture over 1,200 criminals. Media pressure influences the decisions of police and politicians. And that influence is enough to make an otherwise press-shy person talk to the media.
I don't know. From my point of view, I didn't think I had any choice.
Bob Swartz is the father of internet activist Aaron Swartz. In 2011, the federal government charged Aaron with illegally downloading files over the MIT network. Amidst a very aggressive prosecution, Aaron committed suicide, and his death sparked an international outcry.
He was a computer prodigy, an online activist.
He was an idealist who believed we had to live up to something better.
Unlike the Scots, Bob Swartz doesn't like talking to the press.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly hard. And I try to erect some degree of emotional distance, but it's very difficult. mean, what happened was just so shattering that one has a responsibility to make sure that these kinds of things don't happen again.
Bob's goals are ambitious: to make all academic literature free, to modify federal computing laws, and to make structural changes at MIT. So Bob did look for PR help, and he found a professional willing to advise him pro bono.
Well, I think he helped make sense, you know, begin to make sense out of what was going on, you know, try to understand how to approach this. I mean, it was a completely new experience, and I didn't have a clue.
Bob is confronting institutions that have PR experience and deep pockets. But he has the advantages all victims and their families have: a public profile, deep, tragically earned credibility, and an emotional story that provokes interest in arcane-sounding issues. So he can use the media to help level the playing field. But moving from human interest to influence means learning how to attach a personal story to big issues and concrete solutions. In PR speak, this means learning how to bridge. John Walsh.
When I got involved in trying to force the FBI and the Justice Department to stop opposing the missing children's bill, I knew that I would only have a short amount of time on air, and I had to be succinct. I had to be articulate. I had to have a call to action. I better know what I was talking about. And I had to have something to say other than crying and pleading for Adam.
Walsh got his bill passed, and Bob Swartz, advocating after his son's suicide, helped prompt Congress to introduce a bill called Aaron's Law, and MIT to conduct an internal review of its role in Aaron's case. Meanwhile, the Scots have also become advocates for a larger cause through an anti-bullying program they founded called Rachel's Challenge, based on the life and writings of Rachel Scott, Craig's sister who died at Columbine. They say it's the largest school assembly program in the country, and that it's prevented at least 7 school shootings and 500 suicides. But the passion that gives these particular advocates their power also saps their strength. This isn't a product pitch. It's their lives, focused on the worst moment of their lives. John Walsh says,
I say it to every victim. You really don't have an obligation to carry forward. If you can't carry forward financially, if you can't carry forward emotionally, if you can't carry forward because it's destroying your family relationships, then don't do it.
Steve Siegel from the Denver District Attorney's Office says to remember, you can say no to the press. And if you say yes, you can set the parameters. He also says to be realistic about what you can actually get from talking to the media.
You know, you hear the word closure. Telling my story will bring me closure. It just really does not, in my experience, provide that. And what the real search is for incorporating this horrible experience into your current circumstances.
You know, look, my son's dead, and everything else is meaningless as compared to that, but you want to make sure that maybe some small amount of good can come out of such an immense tragedy.
People that say, Craig, how do you continue to talk about it and do the media? You know, it's like, you don't get it. Just join me for one trip and see what I see, and then tell me how could I not do it.
Living in the spotlight is a challenging new reality for victims and their families. As Bob Swartz said, his son is dead. Everything after that is meaningless. But if they can learn how to play the media while factoring in their own limits and tolerance for the game, they may be able to find some meaning, even in the meaningless. For On the Media, I'm Karen Duffin.
Amazon, the largest bookseller in the world, is locked in a struggle with Hachette, one of the biggest publishers. And Amazon has, shall we say, maximized its leverage. Its prolonged shipping times, taken away the option to pre-order new releases, and eliminated the one-click option for purchasing Hachette books. Such Hachette authors as Scott Turow and James Patterson are furious, and some readers, too, are disgruntled. Amid the uproar, Amazon released a statement on Tuesday which said it has the right to seek the most favorable terms from vendors, and it invited frustrated customers in the meantime to, quote, purchase a new or used version from one of our third-party sellers or from one of our competitors. Brad Stone is the author of The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos, and the Age of Amazon. Brad, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you, Bob.
Let's begin by declaring our various conflicts of interest. Amazon's imprint, Thomas & Mercer, is publisher of my novel. Hachette is publisher of your book about Amazon. So we're neither of us exactly disinterested parties.
That's right. And it's a great irony. A book that is at least in part about Amazon's tough negotiating tactics is now in some way affected by those tactics.
The other salient fact is that while Amazon is extremely beloved by consumers for price and convenience and world-class customer service, it's pretty widely be-hated by authors, publishers, and other vendors who have to do business with it. Why is that?
Why do publishers dislike Amazon? It's because for the last 10 years, they've been beaten with increasingly large sticks as Amazon seeks to change the terms of business, to tilt the playing field in favor of e-books. You know, they want to stock less physical books. The Amazon doesn't want old copies of books sitting in its warehouses taking up space. And every time the contracts between the big publishers and Amazon come due, and one came due this spring between Hachette and Amazon, Amazon seeks to change the terms. They say that they're trying to create a more kind of future-forward arrangement to push the industry in the direction of digital, to create a better arrangement for its customers over the long term. But the publishers don't see it that way. They see, you know, Amazon taking more margin, changing the playing field, and putting more pressure on their other partners. So, you know, when Hachette looks at this deal, it's trying to protect, you know, Barnes & Noble, which, as we all know, is kind of teetering, and independent bookstores, which have been under assault for 20 years. So we've seen a kind of steady increasing of hostilities between Hachette and Amazon over the last 3 months.
This particular dispute, what are the issues? What are Amazon's demands that Hachette is not interested in surrendering to?
That's the question. And actually, we kind of don't know. You know, both parties are playing this very close to the vest. You know, I feel like I should be in a pretty good position to know, being a Hachette author, dealing with Amazon quite a bit over the last few years. I can't really say that I do, and I haven't seen it reported authoritatively elsewhere. It probably most likely centers around ebooks and the royalty arrangement. Hachette, like a lot of the other big publishers, is kind of done compromising. I think they feel like they've given up a lot to Amazon, and Amazon is now 30% of their business, in some cases even more, and they're worried about their other channels, and if Barnes & Noble does go down, you know, what it looks like when Amazon controls 50% or even more of the book business.
Does this negotiation have anything to do with that 2012 Justice Department case against three of the big six publishers, including Hachette, alleging that they conspired with Apple to jack up the prices of ebooks on the what was then new iPad device?
There certainly is a connection. The resolution of that litigation essentially allowed Amazon to price ebooks wherever they want. They want to price a book at $6 or $7. So they want to change the royalty distribution to make sure that it represents the new lower price. That's where a publisher like Hachette is resisting, because they see all the overhead that they have, the arrangements that they have with their authors, the big warehouses that they still have to preserve to support the old channels, the bookstores. The new royalty arrangement doesn't work for them. That's why they're at loggerheads, and it's why a lot of the people in the book business kind of blame the Justice Department for kind of going after the wrong monopolist. And the perverse irony, you know, was that they were trying to create an alternative ebook ecosystem, a counterweight to Amazon. You know, unfortunately, they went about it in kind of the wrong way. And Amazon, which does have a commanding position in books, you know, what they're doing is well within the law. The problem is it seems to abandon a core value, which is their customer obsession.
Is there a backlash that you think that will damage that sterling customer service reputation that Amazon has earned?
That's the key question. I think Amazon has shown in the past it is very sensitive to bad press, particularly as it's seeking to extend its brand in new ways, selling phones or rolling out grocery service. They did release a statement recently, and they released it on an Amazon user forum. They were speaking to the business people that were following it, and the language was technical and somewhat convoluted. It kind of said to me that they don't really see this playing out in the public, that insiders care about this. You know, they may be a little bit delusional. I mean, they're making it harder for their customers to get books, to have a good experience on the Kindle, to have quick delivery. These are values that they've trumpeted for the past 20 years, and here in this dispute, they seem to have abandoned them.
All right, I'll leave you with a very simple last question. Brad, what's going to happen here?
I think these companies will kiss and make up sooner rather than later. You know, Hachette has a huge motivation to get this behind them. I mean, their upcoming books, like, you know, J.K. Rowling's new novel, The Silkworm, It's unavailable on Amazon. You know, you can't pre-order it. And that's terrible for the publisher. It's also right now bad for Amazon. They're getting a lot of bad press. Both parties are saying this could take a long while to resolve. I think they're kind of posturing. You know, my sense is that cooler heads will prevail sooner rather than later, and it'll be back to business as usual.
All right, Brad, many thanks.
Thank you, Bob.
Brad Stone is a senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek and author of The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. His book comes out in paperback this fall, and you may see a special promo page on it on Amazon.com, or you may not.
Coming up, a former tabloid hack turns the tables on his cohorts with the dirty tricks they taught him.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the German tabloid Bild published pictures of Kate Middleton's bare bottom, exposed when her skirt flew up during a recent trip to Australia. The British tabloid press was offered the pictures, but dutifully refused them and denounced the German paper. The bottom-feeding Daily Mail went so far as to call it a breach of privacy. Could this mean that British tabloids have seen the errors of their own ways since the infamous News of the World scandal and subsequent Leveson inquiry into press ethics? No. Alongside the story slamming Bild's distasteful publication of Middleton's rear, the Daily Mail Online featured such gems as Toni Braxton narrowly avoids wardrobe malfunction exiting her SUV for dinner at Mr. Chow, and Making It Rain, moment X-Men director Bryan Singer threw hundreds of dollars at male strippers for lap dances at a Hollywood gay bar, complete with pictures. The immutable lowbrowness of the British tabloids is the subject of a new film, One Rogue Reporter, premiering next month at the Sheffield Documentary Festival. Its star and creator Rich Pepiat knows something of which he speaks.
Indeed. I used to be one of those shameless tabloid hacks. I resigned quite publicly 3.5 years ago and leaked my resignation letter to the Guardian newspaper, sort of decrying some of the ethical practices of my paper I was working at, the Daily Star.
Early on in the film, you establish your bona fides as a practitioner of the dark tabloid arts.
When I landed a job at the Daily Star, one of Britain's biggest selling newspapers, what I didn't imagine myself doing would be dressing up as Santa and getting drunk with strippers, or dressing up as a transvestite stripper. I'd like to say that was the bottom of my particular journalistic barrel, but here's me dressed in a burqa. Yup, a burqa.
I had many opportunities I could have left. I wrote a lot of things I regretted. And I do question my own morality. Why did you allow yourself to get involved in this? And why didn't you earlier on say no? There is a degree of this film being me working through that.
The film shows some excerpts of your own testimony before the Leveson inquiry into tabloid ethics, sort of a combination of accusation and confessional.
I resigned before the phone hacking scandal kicked off. And then when tabloid ethics became front page news and it became a big debate in Britain, I guess I got sucked back into it and I became involved in campaigning for press reform in Britain. The turning point is when I went to a seminar that was put on by the Leveson Inquiry. All the top people in Fleet Street, all the top reporters and executives were all invited. And I was asked to give a presentation and I went for the jugular. And let's just say it wasn't very well received. In the film, that's the moment that I went, right, okay, well, if I can't get through, if people aren't going to listen in a serious manner, then I'm going to attempt to do it in a satirical manner, turning the tables on tabloid editors and executives, using the tricks and techniques that they taught me against them to see how they like it.
This movie covers the whole landscape of tabloid trickery and moral bankruptcy. Can you give me some examples of what One Rogue Reporter focuses on?
You mentioned the Mail Online. One of the people that we stunt is the editor of the Mail Online, Martin Clark. We hire a paparazzi to follow him around and take pictures of him, and I ask him some sort of sidebar of shame Mail Online questions that seem to populate that website.
Have you got any gossip for us? Are you on a diet or anything? Are you detoxing?
Who the hell are you?
Who the hell am I? Yeah. I'm doing your job, mate. Just taking a few pics. I saw a nipple slit with Kim Kardashian earlier. Yeah, brilliant. I'll send it in. I'll send it across.
Funny. Seriously, who are you?
Doing my job, mate. Doing my job. You know, taking a few pics.
You wouldn't believe some of the high horses you hear people like Martin Clark get on when they are defending what they call the right of journalism in this country and its proud traditions. It's amazing that the Daily Mail in Britain accused The Guardian of being traitors for printing the Snowden leaks and said that wasn't journalism, that was just irresponsible. Yet they will defend their right to print upskirt shots and nipple slips as if that is journalism. The people at the top of the tabloid industry in Britain don't have any interest in journalism. They're killing journalism.
One of the most stunning episodes in the film is an interview with the former editor of The Sun, Kelvin McKenzie.
Kelvin McKenzie is very famous as being probably the most disliked journalist in the country. He can't even enter the city of Liverpool because of things he wrote about the Hillsborough disaster, a football stadium disaster here 20 years ago. I think the gloves are very much off with anything that you can get on Kelvin McKenzie.
I don't know how you pulled this off, but you are asking him a series of what seem to be hypothetical questions about his publishing standards.
A famous sports star is caught canoodling with a woman who's not his girlfriend in a nightclub. Would you publish or not publish?
I'll publish.
You discover a politician has had an affair with his secretary a day after he's announced he's divorced. Publish or don't publish?
Oh, publish. Oh, dear, oh, dear. You couldn't get a big enough paper.
That one's pretty.
I mean, that one there. I mean, game, set, and match. There'll be readers and editors all going, yes! Yes!
And a third one. You have proof a TV personality is exchanging saucy text messages with a woman who is not his wife. Run the story or don't run the story?
Run the story, depending on what the text messages basically said.
The first two are almost teeing it up. The final scenario is his own scenario of his own life, of which I then start reading out his own text messages to a woman who's not his wife.
In this next bit of tape, we hear text alerts as actual messages previously written by McKenzie himself flash on the screen.
You know, he's indicating that he used to be into rubber. Oh, fetishes.
Fantastic.
Fantastic stuff, eh?
Shocking.
If you bring a tape along next Tuesday, I'll let you measure it. If the text says that.
Well, it depends what the it we're referring to.
I think a penis, probably.
I would say that he was pretty much done for.
Yeah.
I lured him into the interview under the guise that I was from a Canadian production company making a documentary about kiss and tell stories. And he fleed once he eventually clocked that this is not about any old kiss and tell. This is about his own.
I got to ask you, the text messages that are at the heart of this gag, how did you get them?
All I'm going to say is a journalist has to protect his sources, and I'm pleading the fifth. Is that what you'd say?
Well, was it like the phone hacking, though, where laws were broken?
No, it was completely above board. You know, the thing about phone hacking is phone hacking was lazy journalism. I don't think there's anything that was achieved by phone hacking that couldn't have been done with a bit more effort in a legitimate way. And that was really what phone hacking was about. No, we're very proud of that stunt because it took a lot of effort.
He was not your only victim. Tell me some of the stunts involving other of the lions of Fleet Street.
One of my favourites is against a guy called Neville Thelbeck, who is or was the chief reporter of the News of the World tabloid, which shut down in the phone hacking scandal. And Neville's actually pled guilty to phone hacking. He wrote a story for the News of the World speaking about how he'd uncovered this seedy masseuse.
Undercover journalism, huh?
It sort of sums up some of the problems with that sort of journalism. Is this was a couple who ran a naturist B&B, sort of minding their own business. He went in there, wrote this big story in a national newspaper about the fact they gave nude massages and they were swingers. Is it really minding their own business in their own house a topic that should be troubling journalism? Is it just for titillation? And because of that story, they had to shut down their guest house. They lost their business. We managed to get a video of Neville Thelbeck in a massage parlour getting a naked massage. with a rather happy ending.
Now, in the end, this is not just a prank film. There's a point to it. What's the point?
It's about exposing the hypocrisy of the people who decide what you read in your newspaper every day and want you to allow them to be the arbiters of morality and the arbiters of what is news, and showing that these people aren't fit to run a bath, let alone a newspaper. So often they're able to print things in their newspapers and never have to account for those things. Yes, it is puerile at times, but I like to think that by the end, there is a serious point that comes through.
Rich, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Former tabloid reporter Rich Pepiat's new film is called One Rogue Reporter. You can learn more about it at onerogueReporter.com. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Cameron Lindsay, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.